The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated January 16/January 23, 2023. Time is in large capital block letters in black, superimposed upon a white background. The border is traditionally red on the cover, and it still is, with no white inner border because the background is white. Now, the heading, the caption of this illustration reads, "The Secrets of Happiness Experts." This is an illustration done in black, white, yellow, and orange. I do not understand the symbols. There is a lightning bolt emitting from a cloud. There is a happy face and a sad face. These are all rectangles, maybe a square. Two hands pressed together as if they're clapping. One eye. A monitor, perhaps a television or a computer monitor, a bag with the dollar sign on it, a head that has an opening at the top with something being dropped in, something else that looks like a rain cloud, and something else that looks like a sunny cloud, and there you have that. And in the corner, there is a little page-turning edge that says our 100th year. Here's a photo to begin with, and it's captioned Sea Lanes. Now, the photo is mostly brown, and it looks like muddy brown water. But here and there is a large patch of green, really beautiful green acreages, and partly, but mostly actually submerged, is a two-lane asphalt-paved roadway, and that is visible only in the territory of the large green patches. And here is the caption. Three vehicles lie submerged on a road in Wilton, California, outside Sacramento, January 1, following heavy rains on New Year's Eve that breached levees in three different places along the Cosumnes River. Numerous roadways in southern Sacramento County flooded as a result, including nearby Highway 99, leaving at least one person dead. Here is the bulletin by Sonia Mansour. The elections that will shape global politics in 2023. The year 2022 saw right-wing leaders win elections around the world. In Sweden, a party with neo-Nazi roots became part of the governing alliance. Giorgia Meloni now leads Italy's most right-wing government since Mussolini. In South America, however, leftists took the lead with the victories of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in Brazil and Gustavo Petro in Colombia. This year, contests in Nigeria and Pakistan will help shape world affairs, while polls in Turkey and Bangladesh will test the grip of authoritarian leaders. A February 25 vote in Nigeria will likely focus on security issues. Across most of the major metropolitan areas, there are regular kidnappings, says Darren Q, associate professor at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Center-left President Muhammadu Buhari is barred from running because of term limits. Last April, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan was ousted from power in a no-confidence vote. The current leader, Shehbaz Sharif, has faced criticism over his handling of an economic crisis, historic floods, and an upsurge in terrorist attacks. Khan, who was the target of an assassination attempt in November, has been gaining a lot of popularity, says Michael Kugelman, deputy director of the Asia Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. A vote is due by October 12. In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's 20-year rule could be put to its toughest test yet in June, thanks to anger over an economic crisis that has seen inflation top 80%. Still, it is unclear that even a coalition of opposition leaders can challenge him successfully, says H.A. Hellyer at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Similarly, in Bangladesh, observers are skeptical that election reforms will dent the government's ironclad grip. Here's the brief news, one page, good question. Will the U.S. see even bigger strikes this year? By Alana Samuels. A few years ago, it might have been daunting to try to start a union at an arts organization during times of economic uncertainty. But that is exactly what Jory Moss, 34, and a group of professional singers did in early December when they asked the Philadelphia Orchestra Association to recognize them as a union so they could negotiate a contract. A recession may be coming, says Moss, but the pandemic changed what workers are willing to tolerate. The time that we all had to sit in our rooms and think about what we have done, I'm talking about the pandemic, gave us a chance to reflect on the fact that these are conditions that we do not have to stand for. We should be treated better, and we deserve to ask for it, she says. It has been more than a year and a half since waves of labor unrest started sweeping through the country. Thousands of workers have walked off the job for better conditions, and long-shot campaigns, like organizing workers at Starbucks coffee shops, have snowballed, leading to a surge of union elections. Though the strong labor market that emboldened workers is softening, these conflicts will continue in 2023, says Thomas Cochon, a professor of employment research at the MIT Sloan School of Management. I expect what we will see is more conflict, more strikes, more contract rejections, Cochon says, and that's spelled K-O-C-H-A-N. I'm not sure if I've pronounced it properly. Workers are still focused on companies' profits during boom years, he notes, while companies are starting to trim costs to prepare for an economic downturn. It is that difference in expectations, he says, that creates a higher probability of conflicts and strikes. Indeed, workers have staged some of the highest profile workouts as the economic news has become more grim. Corporate giants including PepsiCo, Amazon, Goldman Sachs have announced layoffs, but workers at both the New York Times and Starbucks walked off the job in mid-December. Though companies are jettisoning workers, the job market is still extremely strong, which may be giving workers more confidence. There were 10.3 million jobs open in October, government data show, more than double the average of 4.6 million that month from 2000 to 2020. Around 58% of Americans said they thought they would be able to find a new job if they lost their current one, the highest rate since February 2020, according to the New York Fed's Survey of Consumer Expectations, released December 12. What is different now from past downturns is the changing demographics that are leaving employers short-staffed. baby boomers who stayed in the workforce until the pandemic have left en masse in recent years, while the immigration rate slowed in 2020 and has not recovered. From 2026 to 2036, the U.S. will see its workforce shrink by 3.2%, which means workers will have more power to demand changes, says a recent report on workplace trends by economists from Indeed and Glassdoor. Meanwhile, the changes that many workers want seem to revolve around more than just wages. Moss, the choir member, says she and other workers have no predictability for when they will be asked to work and how much they will earn from one season to another. Lack of control over their schedule, specifically the inability to take sick days when they needed them, was also what motivated four freight rail unions in November to vote down a contract brokered with their employers. Many of these issues will come to a head in 2023 as big union contracts expire. The United Auto Workers will be seeking a new contract with the big three, General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis, the group that now runs Chrysler. The Writers Guild, which represents many working TV and film writers, has a contract that expires in May. And the largest private sector collective bargaining contract in the country between Teamsters and UPS expires July 31. In November 2021, the Teamsters elected a new leader, Sean O'Brien, who beat out a successor hand-picked by James P. Hoffa, who had run the union for 24 years. O'Brien, who took office in March, has a mandate to secure improved conditions for his 340,000 drivers. He has said repeatedly, if workers do not get a better contract, he will lead them on a strike. Next is the page with the milestones. We have five different categories today. Arrested, a criminology doctoral student in the November killings of four University of Idaho students, December 30, at his parents' house in eastern Pennsylvania. Criticized, ultranationalist Israeli cabinet minister Itamar Ben-Gvir for visiting the Al-Azqa Mosque compound January 3, a move Palestinians viewed as deliberate provocation. Sued, Paramount Pictures for more than $500 million, December 30, by the stars of the 1968 Romeo and Juliet, who allege they were sexually exploited as teenagers during filming. Delivered, an in-person New Year's address by the Japanese Emperor, January 2, the first in 3 years since COVID-19 restrictions began. And died Vivienne Westwood, the renowned British fashion designer, December 29 at 81. Rapper Gangsta Boo, a former member of hip-hop group 3-6 Mafia, January 1 at 43. Brazilian soccer legend Pele, December 29 at 82. Judy Berman writes about this recently deceased person, Barbara Walters, icon of journalism. There should be no confusion surrounding the greatest accomplishments of Barbara Walters, who died December 30 at 93. Walters busted barriers for women, joining NBC's Today Show in 1964 and building a reputation that led ABC to hire her away in 1976, as the first woman to co-anchor a national network's evening news program. Over more than half a century, she coaxed revelatory insights out of the world's heroes, villains, and stars. But in 1997, she made another crucial contribution sure to outlive her. She created The View, Despite its chaotic low points, the show introduced a more ambitious paradigm for talk shows aimed at a female audience, women who gossiped and voted, read People and the newspaper. In the world of The View, women are never a monolith. The show did not mark the apex of Walter's career, but its insistence on taking women seriously changed daytime TV as profoundly as her ascendance in the anchor's seat changed the face of broadcast news. And died Benedict XVI, the Pope who stepped down. By David Van Biemma, who is Time's former religion writer and co-author of The Prayer Wheel. Very few things Benedict XVI did while Pope astounded people. Long ago, as a cardinal, Benedict, who died December 31 at 95, so powerfully shaped the conservative pontificate of his friend and predecessor, John Paul II, that his own installation represented continuity. But his 2013 resignation was truly shocking, and it remains his most powerful idea in his years as pontifex. The renunciation, unprecedented in modern times, immediately sparked debate. Was this the way the church worked? That discussion became less theoretical when Benedict's successor Francis turned out far more stylistically, if not precisely doctrinally, liberal than expected. Eventually, with Benedict insisting on calling himself Emeritus Pope and still wearing the traditional white cassock, the retirement generated a kind of bizarro two-pope situation, or at least it seemed so to some conservatives who treated the frail Bavarian in his monastery as a kind of mascot for the idea of a divided church. Francis, meanwhile, was at pains to deny any kind of tension between the two actual men. With Benedict's passing, Roman Catholicism is again unambiguously single pontiff for now. Francis, 86, has considered eventual retirement, citing Benedict's precedent. Whatever the rest of his legacy, that last act is one in which Benedict's name will live on. The brief health. Five wellness trends to ditch in 2023 by Angela Haupt. In 2022, social media inspired many of the ways we tried to get and stay healthy, but not always for the better. Talk about weight loss drugs spread like wildfire online. As did our collective agreement to stop going the extra mile at work. We turned to Dr. TikTok again and again, and focused perhaps too much on body image, even when we tried to keep things positive. The new year is the perfect time to reevaluate these habits, experts say. Here are five wellness trends you would be better off ditching in 2023, plus healthier alternatives. 1. Weight loss shots. Ozempic and Wegovy, two injections that are used to treat type 2 diabetes and obesity, are hot commodities, even among people without those conditions. There are people on Reddit and TikTok and other platforms hearing about it, says Dr. Andrew Craftson, a clinical associate professor in metabolism, endocrinology, and diabetes at Michigan Medicine. But they're not meant to be used willy-nilly. These drugs turn down appetite, leading to weight loss. But people who stop using them typically gain it back. Side effects can include pancreatitis, changes in vision, low blood sugar, and kidney and gallbladder problems. A better long-term plan is to emphasize fruits, vegetables, lean protein, and whole grains, says Dr. Stephen Kopecky, a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic. It needs to be sustainable, he says. 2. Quiet quitting. Doing the bare minimum at work rather than going above and beyond is a risky 2020 trend, says Susan Albers, a clinical psychologist at the Cleveland Clinic. While setting work-life boundaries is a good idea, quiet quitting normalizes staying stuck in a job that does not feel satisfying or suit you. That elevates the likelihood of burnout, stress, and anxiety. Instead, think about what kind of job might be more energizing. Really take the time to look into yourself and your skills, your talents, your passion, and think about whether there is a better match. 3. Diagnosing yourself on TikTok. TikTok users are bombarded with mental health content, leading many to diagnose themselves with whatever condition resonates the most. We see a lot of misinformation being spread, says Kate Kowalczyk, a therapist who practices in New York and California. Combine that with difficulty accessing mental health care in the U.S., and it is a recipe for self-diagnosis. Kowalczyk challenges TikTokers, or TikTokers, however it's pronounced, to double-check mental health information with a credible source and discuss their symptoms with a doctor or other mental health provider who can put them into context and help figure out a proper diagnosis. 4. Overdoing melatonin. Americans are getting less sleep than they did before the pandemic, and melatonin use has steadily increased. That is worrisome for a variety of reasons, including a lack of data on the long-term safety of regular use, and the fact that the over-the-counter sleep supplement is not regulated as strictly as a medication by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. It is time for a shift in how we think about melatonin. A pill does not replace a lifestyle, Kopecky says. Reserve melatonin for special occasions, like if you have traveled to a different time zone and need help adjusting to a new schedule, he says, and make it a practice to stick to a consistent bedtime. Dim your lights, because bright lights can interfere with your body's natural production of melatonin, and go device-free an hour before you want to fall asleep. 5. Body talk. The body positivity movement aims to accept, appreciate, and celebrate all bodies, regardless of size or shape. But at its core, body positivity still reinforces the notion there's value in the way a person's body looks, says Saba Haruni Luri, a therapist in Los Angeles. In 2023, aim to practice body neutrality. That means accepting our bodies as vessels that allow us to go for a run or walk to the mailbox, instead of attaching positive or negative feelings to them. Unfollow social media accounts that promote unhealthy body image ideals, Albers suggests, and switch up your self-talk. Instead of saying things like, I love my body, shift to, I accept my body as it is. I appreciate what it does for me, she says. From the brief news world, COVID-19 curbs for Chinese travelers by Yasmin Serhan. For nearly 3 years, China's zero COVID policies kept most Chinese tourists close to home. But now that the government has dropped nearly all pandemic restrictions, Chinese citizens wishing to go abroad are finding it harder to enter other countries. Amid rapidly rising infections and concerns over the reliability of Beijing's reporting of cases, more than a dozen countries have announced new entry restrictions on travelers from China. The U.S., Britain, Canada, France, Spain, Qatar, and others have reintroduced compulsory pre-flight COVID-19 tests for people flying in from China. Malaysia announced it will screen inbound passengers for fever and test the wastewater of incoming aircraft from China in a bid to detect new variants. Others are adopting more stringent measures. Japan, South Korea, and Italy are requiring all travelers from China to take a COVID-19 test on arrival. The strictest measure has been found in Morocco, where all people traveling from China have been banned from entering the country outright, irrespective of their nationality. Beijing, which in a stunning reversal began dismantling its strict COVID-19 tracing, testing, and lockdown policies last month following rare public protest, has labeled the new requirements discriminatory and vowed to take countermeasures. Still, public health experts have cast doubt on the effectiveness of these measures in keeping potential new variants at bay. Trying to ban a virus by adjusting what we do with travel has already been shown not to work very well, Andrew Pollard, director of the Oxford Vaccine Group, told the BBC. Under the subheading TECH, what happened to FTX's lost $8 billion by Andrew R. Chow? The collapse of the crypto exchange FTX seemed to materialize out of nowhere. In the space of 1 week in November, FTX went from one of the most trusted parts of crypto to a bankrupt disgrace that lost more than $8 billion of its customers' money, according to authorities. FTX's founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, faces criminal charges, including fraud and money laundering. He's free on $250 million bail and entered an initial plea of not guilty January 3 in federal court in New York City. While much of the press coverage has focused on Bankman-Fried allegedly spending customer money on political donations and a Bahamian real estate empire, it appears a far greater amount of FTX money disappeared in the wake of an earlier and lesser-known crypto crash. Increasing evidence suggests the May collapse of the highly controversial cryptocurrency Terra USD, which some critics liken to a Ponzi scheme, may have started a chain reaction financial crisis that brought down first Bankman-Fried's hedge fund, Alameda Research, which made many risky bets on cryptocurrencies, and finally, FTX. A recent report by the analytics firm Nansen, which followed transactions that are publicly visible on the blockchain, shows that after Terra USD collapsed, hundreds of millions of dollars in crypto were transferred from FTX to major crypto lenders that Alameda may have owed money to. The links between Terra USD and FTX could help explain how FTX's losses mounted so quickly and why it will be exceedingly difficult for customers to get their money back. FTX, founded in 2019, allowed consumer investors to buy cryptocurrency and took deposits similar to the way traditional financial institutions work. Alameda and FTX were supposed to operate separately from one another, but Nansen found a slew of blockchain evidence suggesting the companies were likely entwined. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, alleged the same thing in a December complaint, that Alameda used FTX's funds as an unlimited line of credit to trade with. Bankman-Fried claims the commingling of funds between Alameda and FTX was not purposeful, but resulted from his and others' misreading of confusing internal labeling, he told Reuters. That article was slightly abridged. Now, under the subheading Nation, the company fighting the abortion information war, by Charlotte Alter. Dr. Jennifer Lincoln has amassed nearly 3 million followers on TikTok through her frank videos about sex, abortion, and reproductive care. Now the Oregon-based OBGYN is taking on a new role as Executive Director of Mayday Health, a health education nonprofit designed to help patients in states that have banned abortion figure out how to get abortions anyway. Lincoln and Mayday are on the front lines of the next battle over abortion rights. The information war. Mayday launched on the day the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade with the goal of spreading the word about abortion pills, two medications prescribed by a doctor that when taken within 48 hours of one another during the first trimester can safely terminate a pregnancy. For patients living in states where abortion is banned, Mayday lays out the step-by-step process for obtaining the pills through the mail and provides medical information about safety and reliability. The most valuable message anybody can spread is telling the folks who live in those states how they can still make decisions about their own bodies, says Sam Koppelman, a co-founder of Mayday. A wave of new restrictions have curtailed sources of reliable information about reproductive health. Doctors across the country are caught in legal limbo about how to advise patients. In some states where abortion is banned, even school administrators and library workers are discouraged from talking about abortion. More than 50% of abortions in the U.S. in 2020 were medication abortions, and requests for abortion pills have surged since Roe was overturned. Yet many patients do not know the pills are safe or how to get them. Mayday is focused on delivering that message. After the last abortion clinic in Mississippi closed, Mayday put up signs in Jackson saying, "Pregnant, you still have a choice," with a link to its website. When the University of Idaho blocked staff from counseling students about abortion, Mayday drove a digital billboard through campus that read, "They don't want you to know this. You can still get abortion pills by mail." The 501c3 organization has partnered with social media influencers and spent thousands of dollars on Google ads targeting core demographics who might need abortions. It is particularly focused on low to middle income women ages 18 to 44 who live in states that heavily restrict abortion. Mayday does not manufacture or provide abortion pills. It simply provides information about how patients can get them. We tell people nothing, or we can use free speech to point people towards resources that do exist, says Lincoln, and people decide what they want to do for themselves. The Brief Nation. A Uvalde Mother Turns Rage and Grief into Action, by Yasmin Aguilera. There are some photos here, four actually. They're in color. They take up not quite a page. There are two photos atop one another. Lexi's parents honor her with tattoos, clothing, photos, and decorating her grave site. One woman is shown here. She's raised her sleeve above her upper arm to show a tattoo of what looks like a little girl with colorful hair and sunbeams all around her. The lower photo is probably of a male. I think we don't see the face, but I think I see the edge of a bushy black beard. The person is wearing a white speckled denim blue t-shirt, upon which there is a screen print or a transfer decal of a little girl smiling with sunflowers below her, and it says beneath the sunflowers, Lexi Rubia. And there are also medallions that are actually obscuring the face on the shirt graphic, with more photos of a smiling face. Another photo shows what looks like perhaps a little remembrance table. It appears to be in a home, but it's not defined as such, and there are more photos of this smiling little girl. There's a cross with a straw hat on top, and something is draped around it like a large pendant, maybe a class photo. And across the horizontal cross arm, it says, Alejandra Rubio. Then there's a little table with lots of mementos, photographs and pictures of hearts and little figurines with lanterns and a gingerbread man and some candles. And then in the lower right corner of the photos is a picture of a green space, it's level, with trees in the middle ground and in the background. The woman who had her sleeve lifted in order to show the tattoo on her arm is kneeling here at a grave. And there are white poinsettias in vases, and there are some fake flowers, what appear to be fake flowers, and lots of candy canes, perhaps a dozen of maybe 2 or 3 foot tall candy canes that surround this burial space. On a drizzly December evening in Washington, D.C., Kimberly Mata Rubio marched from Union Station to Capitol Hill with dozens of other families from Uvalde, Texas. Her 10-year-old daughter, Lexi Rubio, that's R-U-B-I-O, was murdered in the shooting at Robb Elementary School May 24. Mata Rubio had never been on a plane before the shooting, but this was now her 7th trip to Washington in as many months to pressure lawmakers to pass restrictions on assault weapons. When the march ended, Mata Rubio, 33, was weeping. This is not the vocation Mata Rubio envisioned for herself, but it is now her future. While she is taking on the legislative battles, she's also navigating her complicated and painful grief. She's mourning the loss of her daughter, but also the loss of the life she and her family had before the shooting. Who I was before ceased to exist the moment Lexi died, Mata Rubio says, sitting on a bench outside the U.S. Capitol, December 8, between meetings with lawmakers. This new me, it is difficult figuring it out. As mass shootings in the U.S. become increasingly common, there have been more than 400 in the U.S. since May 24, according to the Gun Violence Archive. She says it should be clear, her anguish could become any other parent's as well. I would receive comments, something along the lines of, I can't imagine what you're going through, she says, and I'm like, well, no. As a mom or a dad, you can imagine. Only when you imagine my pain will you join me in fighting. Christmas Eve marked 7 months since Lexi and 18 other children and 2 teachers were killed by a gunman. Normally, Lexi would help her father, Felix Rubio, decorate the outside of their home for the holidays. They would drink hot chocolate with marshmallows and watch Christmas movies together. This year, the family decorated Lexi's gravesite with Christmas lights and giant candy canes. For decades, no mass shooting produced meaningful changes to gun law on Capitol Hill. December 14 was the 10th anniversary of a gunman killing 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, an event that many thought would lead to federal changes to gun policy, which never panned out. Uvalde was different. President Joe Biden in June signed into law the most significant gun reform bill in nearly 3 decades, which enhances background checks for young gun buyers and funds mental health programs. Still, that law might not have prevented the Uvalde shooter from acquiring his weapon. Mata Rubio says it is not enough. Like many parents of mass shooting victims, she's learning not only the pain of losing a child does not end, but also those in power are often slow or even entirely unwilling to change U.S. gun laws. Mata Rubio has become a public figure, testifying before Congress, speaking directly with lawmakers, participating in rallies in Austin, and sharing her heartbreak with nearly 19,000 followers on Twitter. During her December trip to D.C., she urged the Senate to pass a bill that would reinstate a ban on certain assault weapons, like the one used in the Uvalde shooting and others. The House passed the bill in July, but Senate leadership did not bring the bill to a vote before Republicans took control of the House January 3, all but sinking any possibility of that legislation's passing. "It has been a rough 2 weeks," Mata Rubio tells Time in an interview a few days after the march in D.C. She committed to the Washington trip before Thanksgiving, but since the holiday, her mourning took a new form. "Those traditions we usually do, we are not doing, and Lexi's not here. Had I been in the headspace I am in right now, I probably wouldn't have decided to come." Less than 1 week after her D.C. trip, Mata Rubio walked across the stage in a cap and gown at the St. Mary's University commencement ceremony to receive her bachelor's degree in history. She was wearing a necklace with the letter A. Lexi's full name was Alejandra Ania Rubio. Her family cheered for her from the audience, and an extra-large photo of Lexi filled one of the seats. Mata Rubio and her husband had wanted to move Lexi and her five siblings out of Texas. Mata Rubio used to work as a reporter at the Uvalde Leader News, a local twice-weekly newspaper. But in 2019, she decided to quit and get her bachelor's degree, which she hoped would help her get a job at the FBI or open up other opportunities in journalism outside Texas. "I almost would have taken anything," she says, "whatever, just to get my kids out of Uvalde, experience something different. It was important to me." The family was thinking of moving to Washington State or someplace cold. Lexi liked cold weather. They believed Mata Rubio's college degree would be their ticket out. "That was what we were waiting for to leave," she says. "So I was almost right there. Just too late." Now Mata Rubio will never leave Uvalde. Lexi is there, she says. Mata Rubio testified about gun violence just 3 days before Lexi was buried. "Lexi was firm, direct, voice unwavering," Mata Rubio said in her testimony before the House Oversight Committee. "Her own voice, shaking, but forceful. So today we stand for Lexi, and as her voice we demand action." Mata Rubio has already seen more changes enacted since losing her daughter than many other parents of school shooting victims. Her push for strengthened background checks became law in June. Now her focus has turned to passing an assault weapons ban. Mata Rubio will not comment on the ongoing investigation into the events that unfolded at Robb Elementary School, but says, "If 300-plus officers felt outgunned by one person with an assault weapon, then the average citizen should not have access to that type of weapon." Some of the opposition to the reforms Mata Rubio wants is coming from her own elected representatives. December 8, Mata Rubio and her husband met with a staffer for Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas. According to Mata Rubio, the staffer told her the office would not do anything to persuade Senate leadership to bring a bill banning assault weapons to a vote before the end of the year. Cornyn's office confirmed the meeting to Time, but declined to comment on what was discussed. After her trip to Washington, Mata Rubio returned to Uvalde to figure out what to do next and bear the pain of her first Christmas without Lexi. She wants to return to work at the Leader News, but her first priority is her activism. With the new Congress, there will be a renewed fight for gun safety legislation, a new balance of power in Washington, new lawmakers to confront with her grief. In the meantime, Mata Rubio and her family visit Lexi's grave every day. We're trying to get there earlier these days, though, because it gets darker sooner, Mata Rubio says. And it's hard to leave her in the dark. Seven questions. Dr. Anthony Fauci reflects on his career, battling pathogens and politics, and the lessons he's learned. There's a photograph here of Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's in profile. He has very short, neat gray hair, neither smiling nor frowning, wearing a suit. This is in black and white, a suit. Dark-colored, a light-colored shirt, and a dotted necktie. December 31, this is a question. You stepped down as head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, and chief medical advisor to President Biden, but you are not retiring. What are you calling the next stage of your career? Answer, my wife jokingly calls it a rewiring. I would like to lecture and write and advise to the extent that my advice is solicited. I have 54 years of experience as a scientist at the National Institutes of Health and 38 years running what everyone agrees is the largest and most important infectious disease research institution in the world, and the privilege of advising seven presidents of the United States over almost 40 years. Question, you and your family have required personal security after threats from critics of the COVID-19 response. Did you ever question whether continuing was the right thing to do? Answer, that never deterred me for a moment. I would never ever let that kind of threat from people who are cowards deter me from what I felt my mission is. Question, over the pandemic, science went in and out of favor with the public. How important is it for the public to understand and appreciate science? Answer, we are dealing, unfortunately, with somewhat of an anti-science theme in this country, which is reflected by anti-vax movements and things like that. Political ideation has been very disruptive to the kind of cooperation and collaboration that you need for public health. We are seeing fundamental public health principles being interpreted one way or the other, depending upon what your political ideology is. Question, what do you predict COVID-19 will look like in coming years? Answer, unless we get a surprise with a way out there, totally different variant, we will have greater control as more people get vaccinated or wind up getting infected. We will get little blips and surges, but we're hoping that it never gets to the level where it really disrupts the social order. We may need an updated SARS-CoV-2 booster every year, similar to the flu vaccine. Question. By the way, Alice Park is the writer of this column. Your career has been a series of skirmishes with a variety of pathogens. Which foe has surprised you the most? Answer. HIV and COVID-19 are up there. HIV came on insidiously, and over 40 years later, we're still dealing with it. I was taking care of patients for 3 years, knowing they are dying in front of me, but not knowing what the agent is that's killing them. That is a unique and terrible experience as a physician that I will never, ever shake. With COVID-19, I never would have thought it was going to be prolonged like this and have so many variants. I was hoping in the beginning, when it was so bad, it would be a one-off, that we would have a big blast and then it would come down. But that's not what happened. It's been a terrible ride ever since. Question, is there any unfinished business you left behind when you stepped down from leading the NIAID? Answer, oh, absolutely. There is always unfinished business. We need to get a vaccine for HIV. It is going to be a very formidable scientific challenge, but we need to continue to push the envelope and try to get there. perhaps even a cure for HIV, which I think is going to be even more aspirational, but it is not out of the question. Also, there are big killers throughout the world for which we do not have highly effective vaccines yet, specifically malaria and tuberculosis, not to mention the perpetual threat of a new emerging infection. Question: what advice would you have for your successor? Answer: stick with the science. Number one, always go with the data, with the evidence. And although you may be involved in policy, stay out of politics. Do not at all show any ideology one way or the other. Just be a pure scientist. That's what you need in the job. Judy Berman writes an essay, "What if they gave a Golden Globes and nobody watched?" This will be considerably abbreviated. The Golden Globes will return to TV January 10 for the first time since 2021, with this year's 80th anniversary edition having a lot going for it. Among the most nominated titles are many wonderful movies: The Banshees of Inisherin, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Tar, and shows Abbott Elementary, Severance, The White Lotus. The relatively diverse list of individual nominees includes such deserving performers as Angela Bassett, Diego Luna, Michelle Yeoh, Quinta Brunson, and the Inspection star Jeremy Pope. Most promising, this year's Shindig will be hosted by Jared Carmichael, the thoughtful and hilarious comedian whose confessional HBO special, Rothaniel, was 2022's most acclaimed hour of stand-up. It is all exciting enough to make the casual awards show viewer forget why NBC took a year off from airing the Globes. So kudos to the organizers on that achievement. But before you settle in for another night of tipsy celebrity speeches, it is worth considering not just whether the Globes have improved as an institution over the past 2 years, but also whether they ever merited our attention or their outsized stature within the industry in the first place. To review, presented by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, whose members are all ostensibly entertainment journalists working for overseas outlets, the Globes had already faced decades worth of criticism for their small, inscrutable voting body and apparent susceptibility to influence campaigns. Then a week before the 2021 ceremony, the LA Times published an expose alleging that members' ethical conflicts ran deeper than previously thought. Days later, the post-Me Too Hollywood watchdog Time's Up slammed the HFPA, which had a reputation for snubbing self-evidently great work from black artists, for not having a single black member out of 87. The resulting cascade of controversy led to an industry boycott the following year. Tom Cruise made a big show of returning his Globes, and whether out of solidarity or simply because the A-list was staying home anyway, NBC declined to air the ceremony. To its credit, but surely also to ensure its survival, the HFPA has made several reforms since then. Out of 97 current members, 6 are black, and the addition of 103 non-member voters has further improved the Globe's representation of marginalized groups. A document distributed to the press on the same day that 2023 nominations were announced, December 12, touted the HFPA's recent work with the NAACP, Code of Conduct for Members, and other new policies to eliminate ethical conflicts. Maybe these adjustments are more than just reputation laundering crisis PR. Maybe they are genuinely as earnest and meaningful as the organization claims. Certainly, while the level of star power on the red carpet remains to be seen, rhapsodic social media posts from high-profile nominees like Rihanna, A24, and Selena Gomez suggest Hollywood is already warming back up to the Globes. Of course, all these parties have a vested interest in the awards industrial complex. But, as viewers, we are free to vote with our remotes. It is ultimately up to us whether we want a nominally more diverse version of the tiny disgraced HFPA to continue by virtue of being the first major ceremony on the calendar, setting the tone for an awards season whose winners help determine which movies and shows get made and who gets to make them. Even the Motion Picture and Television Academies, for all their flaws, are more representative of their respective fields and thus better qualified to take stock of any given year in entertainment. The Globes, at their very best, are a waste of a perfectly good evening. If millions of us stop tuning in amid plummeting interest in award shows in general, then NBC might once again be persuaded to pull the plug. That essay was read in its entirety, and there is an illustration, green background, bright golden yellow central figure, which is a foreign press HFPA statue of a golden globe with a golden globe on top of it. This is a drawing, not a photograph. But below this statue is the edge of a saw, sawing a circle around it as if it is about to drop from view. Now, we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.